Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, dubbed the Hip Young Division of the Commonwealth Club, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Craig Miller, Senior Editor for Climate Watch at KQED. Joining us tonight are Bjorn Lomborg, the author and filmmaker of Cool It, and Carl Pope, chairman of the Sierra Club, both deeply engaged in the conversation about climate change and its solutions. And now it's our chance to dig into some of the issues. But first, if you'll permit me just a couple of minutes, I wanted to do a couple of things. First of all, I brought along some props, which I know is the ideal thing for radio. I've got two books here I'm going to hold up. One is Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming, which is Bjorn's second, I believe, and latest book. And also the title and subject of the film, which some of you have seen already at a screening. And the second book I want to hold up is called The Lomborg Deception, which looks like a Robert Ludlum novel, but it's actually not. It's about this gentleman to my left. And I don't mention it to set the tone for the conversation, but rather to just illustrate the kind of fire that this guy has been under the last several years because of his views. You know that when people are writing entire books just to disagree with you, that you've stirred up a hornet's nest. And I'd also like to acknowledge something else, and that is that for those of you who have seen the film, this may have escaped you, but toward the beginning of the film, the late legendary climatologist from Stanford, Steve Schneider, is interviewed, and during that interview, he calls Bjorn a massively negative force and says that he needs to be brought down. And if you watch that film all the way through the credits to the end, you'll see that at the very end, Bjorn dedicates the film to the memory of Steve Schneider, which I think was a very gracious thing to do. And just a personal note on that.
And I think, you know, fundamentally, he's always been welcoming debate. He's unfortunately no longer with us, but you know, despite our disagreement, he was a great guy.
Now, I think people could be forgiven, and Carl, I promise I'm going to get to you in just a minute. But I think people could be forgiven, Bjorn, for seeing you as something of a walking contradiction in some respects. And some of this, I think, comes out in the film that you've just produced, where at the same time you seem to acknowledge openly, yes, the climate is changing, yes, it's due to human intervention and carbon emissions and so on and so forth. No argument there. But you also seem, both in the film and elsewhere, to have devoted considerable time and focus to downplaying some of the predicted impacts of climate change. Polar bears, don't worry, the populations are actually expanding, they'll be fine. Sea level, you know, don't worry about that. We barely noticed the foot rise of the last century. We won't notice the next one either. Do you want to take just a minute and sort of clear the air about some of this and declare yourself about which parts of what I'll call the prevailing science you actually agree with and which parts you don't?
Yes, and thanks a lot for pointing out, yes, global warming is real, it's man-made, it is an important problem. I don't think it's correct to say that I downplayed in the sense of saying, don't worry about the polar bears, they'll be fine. I actually don't say that in the film. I also point out, polar bears are going to have an increasing problem because of diminishing and eventually disappearing some Arctic ice. But what I say is two things. First, we need to stop the panic and the fear tactics. The idea that Florida is going to be inundated, as we saw in Al Gore's film, or the fact that all polar bears will be gone very soon, that's not happening. Because the current way that we try to tackle these problems, both talking about polar bears and talking about sea level rise, is actually not working. And I would say to a large extent, because we're fearful. So this is about scaling back the fear, so we can start having a sensible conversation of what do we actually do. We don't make good decisions when we're scared. We do, and we need to, make good decisions on global warming.
There has been a lot of hype, certainly, about the global warming threat. Carl Pope, too much hype?
I think that Bjorn's and my disagreement is about three basic points. One, Bjorn thinks that the cost and risk of climate disruption is cheaper and lower than the cost and risk of a rapid transition away from a carbon-based energy economy. I think an honest accounting would show that getting off carbon is by far the cheaper solution and climate disruption is by far the greater risk. Second thing is Bjorn clearly believes that pursuing a low-carbon future will get in the way, which is a long-term goal, we agree on that, will get in the way, if we do it too aggressively, of short-term goals like dealing with poverty, disease, violence. And I actually believe that the solutions to poverty, disease, violence, and climate are linked and can and must be pursued simultaneously. And third, I see climate change in the context of what I believe are very, very severely stressed ecosystems on which human civilization depends. And I believe that one of the most severe threats is the interaction between these depleted ecosystems, badly managed, and climate disruption. And I don't think Bjorn's analysis gives enough attention to that. What's important to me is we're clearly not doing enough about any of these problems. In the movie, Bjorn, I thought quite appropriately, asked a member of the U.S. Congress why we hadn't, if the U.S. was such a great country, why we hadn't solved all these problems, which I think is a very good question for all of us, not just Americans. But I also, the implication, I think, was in the way it was framed in the movie, probably not in the hearing room, is that somehow if we only hadn't been worrying about climate change, we would have solved all these problems. I said in the movie that was the implication, not in the hearing room. Well, and I think the reality is we didn't solve these problems before Al Gore put out Inconvenient Truth for rather the same reasons that we're not solving climate change. Not for different reasons, and not because these things are in conflict, but because we have not created a global community that can actually act on either its short-term global threats or its long-term global threats. We have created a global society which time and time again loads the dice against certain parties and rolls them over and over again, and then says, my God, we keep on getting bad results. And if we keep doing the same thing, we'll keep getting the same bad results.
The definition of insanity, right. Yeah. And before Bjorn responds, let's just try to tee up what I gather to be your main thesis here, which is not so much that you disagree with the science, but that you disagree with the approach that's being taken by policymakers to correct the problem or address the problem, right?
Yes. And fundamentally, I think actually Carl summed it up rather nicely, the places that we disagree. It's really a question of realizing that we haven't dealt very well with global warming. We both agree on that. I would tend to point out, and I'm sure we'll get back to that, Carl has certainly been in the public policy majority for the last 20 years, incidentally the same 20 years that we haven't managed to do anything about global warming. And so at some point, I think we need to ask the question, well, do we need a different approach? And that's what the film is about. He says that that we evaluate the cost and the risks differently, and I think it's very obvious that when we look at what we have managed to do so far, it's actually fairly costly policies that will do nothing whatsoever. And if you run all the climate economic models, they invariably show, unless you really tweak the parameters, you end up having a situation where, for instance, the 2-degree centigrade goal, which everybody has ascribed to, and I'm sure Carl would also be talking
started
nicely
with
about
the G8 or the G20
yes.
that came up.
That would basically cost so much that for every dollar we spend, we would avoid about 2 cents of climate damage.
Okay. This now, is that's the idea.
This is the idea that's been put forth
that we should set policy so as to not allow the planet to warm more than 2 degrees.
I do
support that goal, but I don't believe that honest accounting would show that goal will be nearly as costly by even a fraction. But if you just run economic models and you let macroeconomists just say, price is the right way to solve the problem, mm-hmm. which is what they've been saying for 30 years. And yes, that has been the public policy mm-hmm. consensus, although I actually haven't been a part of it, but it has been the public policy consensus.
Pricing carbon.
Mm-hmm. Pricing carbon turns out not to be a cheap way to get off carbon. Mm-hmm. Pricing carbon turns out to be a very expensive way to get off carbon, at least as the public understands it. But getting off carbon turns out, properly understood, to be much, much cheaper if you do it from the bottom up instead of from the top down. So that's where I would urge us to go now, and I've got a couple of examples that I think will show how cheap it could be and how attractive it could be economically and in other terms.
Now, in Bjorn's defense here, you know, he's not just arguing, making a cost argument about cap and trade or carbon pricing. He's also making an effectiveness argument. He's saying it's not going to work, and he's in some pretty good company. James Hansen, for example, at NASA, has come out and said he doesn't believe it's going to work. In fact, he was hoping last winter that Copenhagen would fail because he didn't want to see cap and trade.
If you want a robust defensive cap and trade, you're going to have to get somebody else up on this podium.
Well, let's see what Bjorn has to say.
But fundamentally, again, I'm very intrigued to hear that we have a new way to do the policy that would turn out to be much cheaper. Mm-hmm. But certainly the way the world has been approaching this issue for the last many years, the indication is, and that's also what the UN found, the cost is going to be very significant and the benefit is going to be rather small. And that's why I think we do need to find a different approach. And again, the one that I try to point out and some of the results that we came from some of the world's top climate economists, we gathered 28 of the world's top climate economists and all their proposals to tackle global warming were evaluated by a panel of five of the world's top economists, including three Nobel laureates, found that the best long-term solution was to dramatically increase investment in research and development into green energy, essentially making sure that we have cheap green energy over the next 20 to 40 years. Because if we do that, we have a much cheaper way of actually achieving carbon emission reductions dramatically, because we can also get the Chinese and Indians on board. And just to give you a sense of the proportion, they indicate, the economists, that for every dollar spent there, you would avoid about $11 of climate damage, or about 500 times more good than the current approach.
Yeah, I want to talk more about renewable energy, too. But just to be clear, are you against carbon pricing, period, or just the cap and trade approach to carbon pricing?
No, listen, I think that we're both going to say a carbon price is right. It should be the right amount. And I think in any realistic setting, certainly politically, carbon pricing in and of itself is not going to solve the problem. And I also seem
I think we can agree on that.
Yes. But I would certainly support a low carbon tax, but mainly to, and I think this is the crux of the argument, to realize that can only be used for funding some of the solutions to some of the problems, like, for instance, investing dramatically more into research and development.
All right. Is this fair to say, then? Is it fair to say that, by and large, and I apologize for being the media guy who always has to simplify everything, okay, but most approaches to dealing with climate tend to be divided into those two pillars. You know, there's mitigation and adaptation, okay? The mitigation, what can we do to slow down global warming? The adaptation, okay, it's coming, a certain amount of it at least. What can we do, you know, to prepare for it? You sound like an adaptation guy more than a mitigation guy. Am I getting you wrong?
Yes, somewhat, because I think we both agree that you do need some adaptation to the problems that will already occur. But I think the dramatic difference between Carl and me is that I would say we should first research the technologies so that they become cheap, and then we should put lots of them up. Whereas I think Carl, and I'm sorry, I'm going to mischaracterize probably your argument, but Carl would probably rather want to put them up now, even though they're more expensive. And so I would say, make the windmills cheap and then put them up, whereas Carl would say, no, they're expensive, but it's worth it, so let's put lots of them up now.
Because some of your approach kind of sounds like palliative care for a terminal patient. You know, basically, this was my take on it. You're basically saying, okay, let's channel more money into making the world a better place until it warms up to the point where we can't live.
And that's just not true.
We should definitely
do something now. We should definitely be looking at all the problems, and I think Carl and I would probably also agree on that. Half the world's population or more have other and more immediate problems. They don't have enough food, all this other stuff. We should definitely be concerned about that. But we're talking about global warming here. So the real question is, do we want to do a little now by investing a lot of money in inefficient solar or inefficient wind, mm-hmm. or do we want to wait invest a lot in the research and development so that these green technologies become so cheap that everyone will want to buy them, including the Chinese and the Indian. So the real question is, do we want to pursue a failed strategy and keep pursuing that, or do we want to go down a new route that actually has the possibility of solving global warming in the medium term?
Carl, have we deployed all of this technology too soon?
Well, first of all, I think we haven't deployed that much of it at all. Second, it's actually Bjorn's figures about how much clean energy costs are not, I don't disagree fundamentally with them. Bjorn's figures on how much carbon-based energy costs are ridiculously low. Let me give you an example. Let's take the U.S. coal sector. A third of our carbon emissions, 2 billion tons a year, which is actually about 8% of global CO2 emissions, come from coal-fired power plants. Those coal-fired power plants...
Much higher percentage in this country,
yes,
but globally.
Those coal-fired power plants put out 43% of the mercury that's emitted in this economy. They're the largest source of sulfur. They expose 5 million Americans who live near coal ash piles to the equivalent of smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. These emissions kill 13,000 Americans every year and add to our national health bill $100 billion. None of these costs are currently paid by the consumers of coal-fired electricity in the United States. 76% of the coal-fired fleet in this country is more than 30 years old. And the health costs alone of those plants amount to 5 cents a kilowatt hour of electricity. It turns out that for 1.1 cents a kilowatt hour additional fee, you could, over the next 30 years, replace all of that coal at today's prices with a mixture of efficiency, natural gas, wind, and solar. So, in fact, you would get 10 cents for every penny you invested, and that's before I take any credit for any benefits to the climate. We have a huge public health problem in this country, which results from the fact that carbon-based fuels kill lots and lots of Americans. And my solution is, let's send coal and oil their full bill. And let's not argue right now about what the climate bill ought to be. Let's send them the rest of their bill, and let's see if they're still competitive with efficiency and renewables. Because I think an honest accounting will show they're not. We're already at the point when a clean energy future is cheaper with honest accounting than a carbon-based energy future. Now, we should do the research. We should bring these costs down more. Because right now, the cost is a factor of all energy. There are 400,000 villages in India without any electricity because the cost of all forms of electricity is too high. So I am completely in favor of reducing the cost of electricity. But I'm saying right now, clean electricity is actually cheaper than dirty electricity.
Apparently you have some folks here who agree with that. Bjorn, do you see some merit in that?
Well, I definitely think, and we would totally agree on that, that we should price all the costs into all forms of energy. I do not know the numbers that you are referring to in the U.S., but certainly I would be surprised, given the fact that you actually have an acid rain program. You basically have already prices on emissions of sulfur, which is the main part of the reason why you have particulates that kill people. I would imagine
we exempted half of our coal fleet from those rules. So, and for 8 years, George Bush didn't enforce the rules. So it is quite remarkable that this late in the game, we have this many dirty coal-fired power plants. But we have coal-fired power plants operating in major American cities built in 1925 with no pollution controls on them.
And clearly, that's not right. So the point here still remains, though, that in Europe, where we have much, much higher taxes, we can still not make renewables work. We can only make renewables work by dramatically increasing the subsidies, which essentially is a way to make sure that we spend a lot on doing very, very little. Let me give you one example from Germany, which is probably the most extreme example. Germany is the world's leading consumer of photovoltaics per capita. If you've ever been to Germany, you know that that's slightly odd, right, given it's not the sunniest country in the world. But they basically provide...
It beats Denmark, Bjorn.
True, but almost everyone beats Denmark in that account. But fundamentally, they are spending about $75 billion extra on subsidies on these solar panels, the net effect which will be to postpone global warming by the end of the century by 7 hours. And that's just ridiculous, to spend that much money on so little effect.
Now, there's you do a lot of that in the book and the film, is these calculations that bring things down to dollars and cents and hours and minutes. Where are you coming up with this?
Well, I mean,
where do you get the 7 hours?
The dollars comes from the Germans' own estimate of how much they've already locked themselves in to supporting the solar panels over the next 20 years, because that's the lifetime of the solar cells. They also have an estimate of how much CO2 that's going to save them, which actually translates into a CO2 cost of about $1,000 per ton, which, of course, is ridiculously high, given that you could have cut probably about 100 times as much had you spent that money elsewhere. And then if you plug it into a standard model of how much is that going to reduce temperatures, you get those sorts of 7 hours. Of course, there's no way that we would ever be able to measure this. Obviously, it would be lost in even day-to-day variation. But I think the crucial point here is to recognize that if we just talk about these generalities, solar panels are good because they cut carbon emissions and that helped fight global warming. That sounds nice. But if you then start saying, but $75 billion to do virtually no good 100 years from now is actually dumb. We need those sorts of numbers, and I'm happy to have other people engage and say, no, Bjorn, it's actually 8.5 hours, and that's fine. Yeah, and obviously, but it's very unlikely that you would find a model that would get more than 24 hours. And so,
using examples like that, let me just ask you, because in your book you make the point that hitting the fear and hysteria button too much, too often, eventually will create topic fatigue. People won't even want to deal with it. At all, but by the same token, isn't saying that all this effort is only going to delay global warming by 7 hours, doesn't that have the same effect? People want to just throw up their hands and say, well, then why bother?
Well, I certainly hope it doesn't. What it should have is it should have the impact that we don't do stupid policies, that we don't do things that just make us feel good, but that we do things that will actually do good. Mm-hmm. So this is absolutely about saying, let's not just hit the fear button and make sure that we do something that has good PR. In the film, I try to point out the idea of the Earth Hour, where World Wildlife Fund gets everyone to turn off the lights. Do you remember in a Saturday night, you have to turn off your lights for 1 hour? Mind you, not your computer. Not your dishwasher, not your washer, not your TV, not your heater or your cooler or anything else. Just the lights. And of course, first of all, we can't measure the impact at all. But even if you turn on two lights, candle lights, as many of my friends do, you actually emit more CO2.
Bjorn, as I recall, most cultures, including Denmark, have symbolic moments and celebratory things that don't really. And I don't think that was intended to be a symbolic moment. I think it's really kind of a huge distraction. The people who did that didn't think they were saving the planet directly. They were saving the planet, they hope, by getting a lot of people commonly engaged in the effort to do so. It's perfectly fair to point to stupid policies, but I think it's a little silly to say, maybe it shouldn't have been yellow ribbons that Americans use. Maybe it should have been pink ribbons.
I actually don't agree with you on that, because fundamentally it sends the signal that dealing with global warming is easy. And let me take you a different and much more concrete example. When Al Gore went on Oprah, they went to Home Depot to buy energy-saving light bulbs. And the sense was, hey, if we do that, we're well underway to dealing with global warming. And the answer is, no, we're not. Even if all Americans, even if everyone in the Western world changed all their light bulbs, it would be the equivalent of 1 day of the emissions of China. Yeah, it's by all means do it. I'm not saying don't do it, but let's not believe that that's the solution, because I actually think it sends that signal of saying, hey, it's easy. And then, of course, when we come later around and say, it's actually going to be really hard, people go, but you told us it was easy.
Well, Bjorn, I think that's actually a different example, because that was an attempt to send a message, this is what you should do, and it is a very, very small part of a large and complex solution. I would merely argue that it's actually not. It's hard in the sense of doing anything is hard. Doing anything collectively is hard. The world's not good at it. But in fact, I don't think that if we organized ourselves in an effective way, and I agree with you, Kyoto was not effective, that the challenge of finding a low-carbon development pathway forward for India and China and a lower-carbon reconstruction pathway forward for the United States, Europe probably has a harder time because you're more efficient than we are already. And China and Japan has the most difficult time because they're the most efficient. But what we ought to be doing, and where I will fault you, is yes, it is true. You've made some very accurate and appropriate comments about the ineffectuality of Kyoto. But I don't think you've offered an alternative that is adequately robust to the actual seriousness of the short-term and urgency of the problem. And I actually think your writing seriously understates the gravity of that. And I'll give an example from our debate at Harvard. We talked about Bangladesh. I raised the question of how we were going to protect the Sundarbans. In that debate, you said this is an area of the coastal low-lying islands at the southern end of the Gangetic Delta. And you said that we could build seawalls, and I asked you if you'd been to the Sundarbans, and at that point you hadn't been. You may have gone since then. But in your book, you have this figure you use where it's an unbelievably tiny fraction of Bangladesh that you say is going to be flooded, 0.000385%. On that page, there's actually no citation, but later on you quote a similar figure for another country, and there is a citation. And you go to the citation, and it notes, by the way, we're only talking about dry land. In a world in which sea levels increase by 15 inches, which is about what the mid-range is and what you're counting on, 22% of the world's wetlands will, in fact, be flooded. Now,
and I write
millions
that.
Of, but you don't put it in the book. It's way back in the notes. And millions of people live on and off of wetlands. Rice farming in coastal areas is done in wetlands. Fishermen, about 1 billion people in the world live as subsistence fishermen, mostly depend on wetlands for their fisheries. So nowhere in your book do you say, by the way, in this world I'm pretty optimistic about, South Louisiana's gone, the Sundarbans are gone, the fishing areas of Vietnam are gone. There's no real acknowledgement of the severity of the impact on real human communities of what your pathway on climate leads to. I agree with you. Kyoto's not an adequate alternative pathway. I think we need to come up with something better, and we need to take it with some urgency. I think we can do it, and I think your writings actually don't take people down the right pathway.
All right. And that's certainly a challenge. And you mentioned several different things. Let me first talk about Bangladesh and the impact. I actually believe, I'd be happy, but we probably have to do this afterwards. I actually believe I do write that it does not take into account the wetlands. But fundamentally, I'm curious to know if you realize that Bangladesh has actually been increasing in area since the Bangladeshis started to account since the 1970s?
Yes.
Good. All right. So, but you failed to mention that. Moreover, and I think perhaps more importantly, the real question here is, and I think the Dutch are a very, very good example of that. Are we going to help the Bangladeshis predominantly by cutting carbon emissions? Or are we going to help them by making sure that they get rich so that they can actually defend themselves? And there, it's very clear that what really matters is whether they get rich or not, not whether we manage to shave off 1 or 2 inches of sea level rise.
And while we're on the subject of sea level rise, you know, in the film and presumably in your book as well, you're buying into the estimation for this century of another foot on average
from
sea level rise.
Half to 2 feet.
I've seen estimates that go well beyond that. Carl, where do you come down on sea level rise? I know you're not a scientist per se, but...
Well, I think this is a black swan problem.
Okay.
Which is, it's statistically likely that Bjorn's figures are correct. Those are not Bjorn's figures, those are the UNFCCC's figures. Yep. Those are the mid-range estimates. The problem with a number of these things, and sea level rise is one example, but it's actually not the most spectacular example, is there's a chance, not 50%, but maybe 5%, of something very much more dramatically happening. And we can't actually predict it. We don't know. Bjorn says, for example, about hurricanes, and I think he's right. We actually don't know what happens to hurricane severity with various changes in global climate. We just don't know. The problem is if we change the climate, in spite of the geoengineering in the movie, it's a little late to call it back. And if you have the possibility of a catastrophic outcome, which you can greatly diminish at a reasonable cost, and this really is perhaps where Bjorn and I disagree. I think the cost of getting off carbon is very reasonable. He thinks it's very unreasonable. You ought to do it. I believe in buying insurance. My house is not likely to burn down. And because of where it's located and how it's built and because it is a multi-unit building with a sprinkler, I am almost certainly paying more for my fire insurance than the actuarial calculation would justify. If I can find a cheaper insurance policy, I should find one. We should have smart policy. But even if the insurance policy I can buy is a little expensive, I can afford it, and I can't afford to have my house burned down, so I buy it. And I am saying we should get off carbon fast because it's an insurance policy we can afford, not against 15 inches, but against something much larger, statistically not probable, but definitely more than 1% if we listen to the scientists.
And the planning parameter, I will say here in California at least, for officials is something like 16 inches by mid-century and 55 inches by the end of the century, which isn't a foot. Now, that may just be playing it really safe, but what do you think about the insurance argument?
Well, I think it underscores very well the other point that Carl brought up, namely the pathway to actually helping both Bangladesh and to dealing with these problems is very, very bleak in the current scenario. We're not doing anything. And so the real question is, how do we help Bangladesh and how do we insure ourselves? Well, currently, the insurance seems to be to have rich countries, that is especially, as you mentioned, Japan and Europe, do something, the U.S. perhaps doing a little bit, and the rest of the world do virtually nothing. And the net effect is virtually nothing. So if you want to use the insurance metaphor, and I have to warn you, it's not actually an incredibly accurate metaphor, you're essentially buying an insurance policy that end up costing a little more than the house, but you only get the door insured. That's a bad deal. And so if you really care about the insurance part, and I think there is an argument to be said that things could get very, very much worse, you do need geoengineering. Because let's face it, we are not going to get China and India to cut their carbon emissions over the next 20 to 40 years dramatically.
I don't know that we're going to get us to cut them dramatically.
Well, I mean, I'm even assuming that Carl is successful in getting, which I would think is somewhat unsuccessful, but getting as successfully the rich world to really dramatically cut our carbon emissions at very high cost now. But even if we managed to do so, we would not get most of the world to dramatically change their emissions. Now, by the second half of the century, absolutely. And that's about making sure that we invest dramatically more in research and development into green energy. But as far as it goes, we're not really going to buy any insurance. So the real point here is to say, let's make sure that we deal with the main case scenario, which is invest dramatically more in research and development, and then invest in geoengineering if we want to make sure that we actually have a cheap and viable policy for the risk. And that, incidentally, is also exactly what the Nobel laureates came out with, saying those were the two top priorities if you actually want to spend money smartly. Oh, and by the way, what we say in the film.
Carl may want to weigh in
on... We can agree on the research, so let's put that aside. We're all in favor. That's an active and an important engagement. The idea that we would engage in geoengineering as our only fallback...
And let's define that.
Well, actually, there are two kinds of geoengineering, one of which isn't talked about in the movie and Bjorn doesn't talk about in general, which is to actually try to restore the natural ecosystems which created climate stability for the 10,000 years of the policy.
Okay. But in
which
this
means,
context,
no. Yeah, which means doing things like reforesting.
Right.
And restoring the carbon levels of agricultural soils by stopping the overuse of nitrogen fertilizers.
But when Bjorn says geoengineering,
Bjorn's version, the version he talked about in the movie, I don't know if that's his, is using technical means to increase typically the albedo of the Earth and reflect more sunlight out. So you're going to change the Earth's temperature without halting the changes we're making in the composition of the atmosphere.
So these would be things like spraying particulates into the atmosphere.
Or little mirrors. Little mirrors
back.
That reflect back. Or big mirrors up in orbit.
Brightening the clouds artificially.
The problem with all of those technologies is they simply create some new disrupted climate. They don't restore the stable climate that civilization grew up depending on. And they don't solve all of the problems. One of the very direct problems we know about with CO2 concentrations is ocean acidification. And geoengineering could actually make that worse. Many of the technologies that are talked about involve increasing the pH of the biosphere. I mean, I'm not sure increasing, you could make it more acid. I can't remember which way it goes. Bjorn will know. So I think it's quite remarkable to jump from research, which I'm in favor of, to geoengineering without saying, wait a minute, in between, 20% of the carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere every year results from deforestation. A reasonable global program of restoring biological carbon in soils and forests would add another 20%, and the cost is very low. I mean, it's really trivial.
So, Bjorn, just to be clear again, do you advocate what I'll call radical geoengineering as a last resort, or should that be like on the table up front as a...
I'm simply saying that if we actually care about the really disruptive climate change, it's the only thing that's going to work. Carl again says we could do something about forests, we could do something about making sure that the soil soaks up more CO2, that's all great, but it's not actually going to avoid dramatic and runaway climate change. It's just not. And the second thing, and the reason why we don't talk about reforestation is actually, although all the numbers look really, really nice, if you try to look at them, the estimates is that for every dollar you spend, you probably avoid about a dollar of climate change. So it's not a great deal or anything, but it's not a bad deal either. The problem fundamentally is it's very hard to verify. And what do you do if you pay the Brazilian government or the Indonesian government a lot of money to keep all these forests alive, and then they don't in 20 or 30 years? Because we actually have to keep this going for the next 100 years. It's that's the main reason why this is... It's a very appealing point. And, of course, you're also advocating a lot of other environmental areas where you'd like to see more forest. But the problem is that it's actually very hard to verify. So it's not necessarily the best way forward. But no, let me disagree.
It's actually two things. It's no longer hard to verify. It's getting very... It's now with satellites and various other things, it's fairly easy. But also... Yes, I actually don't believe you should buy these forests from the Indian. You should rent them. And every year they're there, you ought to pay them.
Oh, and that's, of course, going to be incredibly more expensive. Let's just remember, if you're going to talk about verifying it as these simple satellite, oh, yes, that's much, much easier. But then you have to rent every single hectare in the world.
Acre.
And that's
going
to be incredibly costly. If you're going to ask somebody to say, don't cut down this forest, they're going to say, sure, and cut down something else. So you actually have to buy all of this, and then it turns into an incredibly bad deal. And again, I'm sorry, these are the numbers.
I think it's very important to talk about Indonesia and Bangladesh and Brazil, but allow me a parochial moment to talk about California. The policies that the state has put in place, in the absence of any federal action or really multinational action, the state has been seen by many as a kind of a leader. But those policies are under attack, as you both know, and they're under attack on the national level as well. Do you think that's right, Bjorn? Do you think that the California, in its leadership role, was on the wrong track and that those policies should be under attack?
Well, Craig, first of all, let me say as a general disclaimer, I know, coming from Denmark, that when Americans come to Denmark and tell us how we should do stuff, it doesn't play well. And I think it would be the exact same way around. I don't think it would be right for me to go in and say what you should and should not do. With respect to forest, if I understood you correctly, if that was the point that California has been leading on...
Well, not specifically on forest, but in decarbonization in general. We have a climate law here that would set up a cap-and-trade program, a regional cap-and-trade program, and price carbon, et cetera. Now, you've kind of already said...
And fundamentally, the argument here is to say... If you look at forests, all rich countries are generally reforesting. That's great, and we should certainly do that. I would mainly say for other reasons, simply because there's lots of biodiversity and there's lots of life quality in forests, and that's the main reason why we should do it. There's also some benefits to climate, and by all means, let's do it, but let's not kid ourselves and believe that this is what's going to, for instance, avoid catastrophic climate change, which was what we were talking about. For California, on cap and trade, I think the same point applies. If it's a small carbon tax, it might be useful, although very often if it turns into a cap and trade, you end up exempting the biggest polluters. And again, I'm not sure exactly how you would set this up. You end up exempting the biggest polluters. You end up giving away a lot of the permits, and it ends up being a fest for a lot of lobbyists and a not very effective climate program. So I would be cautious to say that that's the right way forward, and certainly is not the solution, because the solution really requires us to get much deeper cuts, both from the developed, but especially the developing world.
And let me just interject that we're pretty close to the time when we're going to be opening up to questions from the audience, which I'm looking forward to. So you might want to start lining up at the microphones now, so we're ready to go when that time comes. Carl, did you want to say something on this?
I was amused in the movie when I think it was Roger Pielke was lamenting the fact that there were all these climate scientists.
University of Colorado climatologists.
Who were being incented by the fact that their livelihoods depended on continuing to keep people alarmed about climate change, and therefore that this might tilt the debate. Well, we here in California do know that there are a veritable legion of carbon lobbyists who will descend upon any geography that tries to do anything serious about the carbon economy. We've had $100 million spent this year by three big oil companies, our public utility, on three different propositions, each one of which was designed to weaken the state's clean air laws. I think they're probably all going to fail. I mean, people are voting now, so they haven't finished voting, and we'll see, but I think people are going to fail. But I think the interesting thing to understand is, and here I think, Bjorn, that there are, in fact, a great many viable pathways in the United States to reduce our reliance on carbon that make fantastic economic sense and which don't happen because coal and oil companies have enough power to prevent them from happening.
But it is
perhaps, perhaps those opportunities do not exist elsewhere in the world. And I'm not an expert on Europe, so I'm going to follow your very sensible rule and not talk about what you know a lot more about than I do. But I do think that the California experience is, even when you try to do things that have tremendous public support, are quite modest economically, that the business community, broadly speaking, likes, you will find coal and oil coming out of the woodwork to squash you like an ant. That's why it's hard for the world to do something about this, because even if we find a pathway that's good for almost everybody, it won't be good for everybody, and those who are losers will fight back hard.
And that's absolutely true, and we can only agree on we should do very smart things, and we should definitely do things that make sense for virtually everyone, and I'm sorry to hear if that's politically hard to do. However, with that said, and again, looking at the rest of the world, but certainly looking at many of the opportunities, like solar, like wind, we know that they require significant subsidies in order to work, which is a telltale way of saying that it is going to be hard. And Carl, you've said several times, doing anything is going to be hard. And let me just, before we move to
We're running out of time here. Just very briefly,
the point that I try to make in the film is, instead of doing something that's going to be very, very hard, let's make it very, very easy. Imagine if we, through research and development, could make green energy cheaper than fossil fuels. It wouldn't have to be hard to convince people to switch, because they would switch because it was cheaper. So it's a little bit like saying, remember, it wasn't hard to get people to switch to cell phones. It wasn't hard to get people to switch to computers. We didn't have to convince people. We didn't have to tax typewriters to get people to move to computers. If you make the technology cheap and effective, people will switch. That's the trick. Don't try to make it hard. And don't try to do it while it's hard. Make sure that it becomes easy. And then, of course, we don't have to have these giant meetings where everybody try to beat each other over the head with saying, no, you got to do it. And China says to the U.S., well, you should do it first.
Well, and speaking of those giant meetings, they haven't worked out real well. And some people are actually saying it's time for a whole new paradigm to move forward. And Carl, you would even agree with that, right?
Well, I think the current UNFCCC negotiating process is clearly not worked, but I think it's partly because and it's not framed properly. My view is we ought to think about carbon as trash. If I dump trash and somebody picks it up for me, I have to pay them. When I dump carbon and somebody stores it in their forest, I ought to have to pay them. It's very simple. Carbon is trash. When you emit it, it goes somewhere. And it doesn't stay here in the United States. You know, mostly we're not storing our own carbon here in the U.S. A lot of it's being stored in various other places that we don't own. And we ought to move towards a system in which if you store carbon, you get paid. And if you emit carbon, you pay just like if it was confetti.
And let me stop you right there so that I can take a moment and remind our audience that this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum division. And tonight we're hosting an evening in conversation with the skeptical environmentalist, author, and Cool It filmmaker, Bjorn Lomborg, and the chairman of the Sierra Club, Carl Pope. I'm Craig Miller, senior editor for Climate Watch at KQED in San Francisco. And I think it's time to go to the audience for some questions. We've got a pretty good line at the microphone, sir.
Thank you. I'm Ed Barry. I'm the director of the Sustainable World Initiative in Washington. We do a rather unique thing. We look at the total demands on nature and on resources that humanity puts out there, and we compare that with the capacity that Earth has to provide resources. And when you look at the results of these studies, kind of no matter how you look at them, you come to a conclusion that we're already in dramatic global resource overshoot.
And so can you put that in a form of a question?
I will. I will. You sort of summarize it in this sense. We're in the fourth decade of global overshoot. So my question is for Bjorn. You put out a lot of solutions and, in fact, even put out a budget. But have you ever done a balance on the resources, the global resources needed to actually accomplish what we're trying to accomplish for sustainability?
Yes, and I'm sorry, I don't know of your particular version of it, but it sounds like the ecological footprint version, and I certainly have looked at that. Yes, and the main problem with the ecological footprint, which is the background for the typical story of saying that, you know, if everybody lived like the U.S., we'd need five planets or that kind of measure, and which also indicates the overshoot, is that the vast majority, actually about 75% and even bigger towards the mid of the century, comes from storing carbon emissions. That is, the putting out carbon emissions, and I think both Carl and I would agree that that is long-term unsustainable. But the problem is that they suggest that that should be measured in area as a way of reforesting. And then essentially we're saying we need four more planets to reforest. But of course, forests is an incredibly area inefficient way of storing CO2. You know, if you want to cut carbon emissions, you plant windmills or solar panels, which first of all don't have to be on arable land, and secondly is actually very, very area inefficient. And then you actually have a situation where we are much below the Earth's carrying capacity now, and we will remain so because we've become more efficient at virtually all the things, especially, of course, of agriculture, certainly to 2050.
Since that question was directed to Bjorn, Carl, is it okay if we've got a long line at the microphone?
Keep moving.
Let's go ahead and move to the next questioner.
My name is Hannah De Los Santos. I'm a Commonwealth Club member. Respectfully, Mr. Lomborg, you sound very reasonable. And given your background in political science, I believe, and game theory, it's amazing that you have such conviction about this issue. I'm confused, however, because the Danish Committees on Scientific Dishonesty cited the skeptical environmentalist for fabrication of data, selective discarding of unwanted results, selective citation, deliberately misleading use of statistical methods, plagiarism, and deliberate misinterpretation of others' results.
And I'm glad that came up, because Bjorn, you do address that in the film.
Yes. You're absolutely right that this is actually, I presume you've taken this off Wikipedia. It was part of the... Okay, well, it was part of the list that they never actually addressed of whether they thought that I was guilty of this. They ended up citing me for being in breach of good scientific conduct. But the curious point was that this was a 16-page verdict that had no it did not have one example of what I'd done wrong. And of course, that was also why it eventually got overturned by the Danish Ministry of Science and as an entirely unfounded accusation. And so I'm very happy you brought it up, but it really is one of those points where, if you will, a lot of people politically want it to silence me. And you know, I'm fine with debate, and that's what we're having here. But honestly, that was a what do you call it, character murder? Is that
character assassination?
Yeah, character assassination.
Well, this source absolves you only because of your lack of that you were out of your depth in terms of
and that, you're right that that was one of the insidious comments that they made. And you know, I think it stands to a point for their own account that they actually managed to say that as well, but managed to have zero. I'm not saying one, two, three, four, five examples, but zero examples, but nevertheless felt justified to say that I'm an idiot. You know, I honestly find, and you know, there's a lot of people who don't like me. There it is. But I think fundamentally, this is not about liking or disliking. It's about having good arguments, and that was not it.
You wouldn't consider yourself a climatologist.
Oh, absolutely not. You know, we shouldn't, and as Carlos pointed out, you know, you shouldn't trust me because I say something about climate, just like you shouldn't trust Al Gore. Or you should trust the UN climate panel. These are the thousands of scientists that we've asked to tell us what's going to happen with the climate. And likewise, you also need to listen to the economists who are going to say, well, how much is it going to cost? Because we do need to realize that we can't do everything.
Thank you. Next question, please.
You've advocated small carbon taxes to fund just R&D activities. So my question to you is, why would larger carbon taxes wreck the economy? I hear this again and again, that if we tax carbon, if the price is too high, things fall apart. If it's revenue neutral, if this offsets my income taxes or other tax revenues, why does this destroy our economy?
Yeah, it's important to point out it does not wreck your economy. Just like, you know, global warming is not the end of the world, cutting carbon dramatically is not the end of the world either. These are, you know, scare tactics on both sides, if you will, of the argument. If you dramatically reduce CO2, and if you, for instance, try to live up to the 2-degree centigrade limit, the economic estimates show that it will cost about $40 trillion by the end of the century per year, or about 13% of global GDP. That's not 100%, and remember, we'll be a lot richer. Now, a lot of people would still think a 13% would be a lot, but it's not 100%. So it would not wreck the economy. What it would do, and you're absolutely right, it should be revenue neutral. It should be refunded through your income tax. That would probably be the most efficient way. Remember, no legislation that we've managed to do so far manages to do that. It often ends up being used either just simply to fund the deficit in general, or to be used for other, you know, by other lobbyists simply, you know,
some of it does propose offering like subsidies to offset people increases in people's utility bills and that
But let me just explain very quickly why it does actually cost money, because basically you're making energy, which is one of the engines of growth, more expensive, which means that it'll be harder for you to do stuff, even though you, of course, don't burn your money, but you recycle it elsewhere. And that's why, so this is not a cost in terms of how much you're going to pay, but it's a cost in terms that it creates a small drag on the economy that builds up across the century.
Okay, Carl, I take it you would agree that pricing carbon won't wreck the economy.
No, and I would actually argue that, in fact, given the enormous subsidies which carbon-based fuels enjoy, and in particular the fact that one of our very important carbon-based fuels, oil, in the case of both the United States and the European Union, largely is imported, and most of the money we spend, it's about $750 billion that the EU and the United States spend on importing oil every year, and about $500 billion of that is spent viciously. It is spent in highly destructive ways by governments that use it for bad purposes. And we really could probably make the world a much better place if both Europe and the United States were to gradually but aggressively reduce their dependence on imported oil.
We're coming down the home stretch, and so I have to ask for succinct questions and answers, gentlemen, if you could. Yes, please.
Good evening. Hi. So in the movie, you suggest a policy, a budget of $250 billion, a lot of which goes into R&D for future technologies. And living and working in Silicon Valley, I know there's a higher rate for startups. Not every single one of them turns into a successful company. Do you assume something in terms of a rate of failure, or do you assume the same level of success for something 5 years from now in R&D that you do to a solar panel that we could invest in today? The other question was, Nicholas Stern is an economist in the UK who seemed to be looking at a lot of the same issues that you were looking at. The conclusion he came to is if we reduce carbon to sustainable levels, it will actually save us money rather than costing it. So what do you think he's getting wrong?
The Stern report should be right, which suggests that the price of doing nothing is higher.
2 points. Yes, most of the investments we're going to make are going to fail. But that's okay. One of the reasons is we need to make sure that we invest in a large number of different technologies. But it's okay that most of these are going to fail, because the ones that are going to succeed are the ones that are going to be powering the rest of the 21st century. So it really is. I'm not sure. You have to go back to the original paper by Chris Green. No, you can ask Chris Green, who wrote the paper for the Copenhagen Consensus.
So he's the one who's actually. We need a couple of game changers to come along here.
Yes. The second question is Nick Stern came up with a very different result, and as I can see, we have very, very little time. I go into this in the book, and I'd be happy to talk more to you about it. But fundamentally, he was asked by the British government to come out with this conclusion. Two other people declined before he took the job. Not that Nick Stern is dishonest, because he truly believes it, but he was certainly selected to come up with that. And fundamentally, he tweaked the very essential parameter, namely the discount parameter, dramatically to make it work, to make the economics look like it's a good idea. And you can only do that if you also assume that everyone in this room would be spending 97.5% of their income on future generations. Now, we don't.
But just to clarify, quickly, Carl, what Nick Stern assumed and what Bjorn disagrees with was that, unlike the other studies, which are the ones Bjorn trusts, which assume that something that if somebody dies 25 years from now, it's only a third as important as if they die today, that lives in the future are not worth as much as lives today, which is actually true for us, but it's, of course, not true for the people in the future. And Nick Stern assumed that, in fact, we ought to value future lives as much. And the studies which Bjorn refers to typically have used 2 to 3% discount rates, which translates into every 25 years a life is only worth a third as much. This is a complicated question, but that is the crux of the disagreement.
Yes.
Let's try to get another.
But let's remember, nobody actually,
try to get another question or two. One per customer, please.
Sure. So tagging onto that same question about the $250 billion, you mentioned in the film that Kyoto would take, I guess, $250 billion each year until 2100 to actually get that through and implemented. What in your plan is similar to what's in the Kyoto figure, $250 billion, and what's overlap there?
Well, it's actually the EU 2020 policy that's $250 billion, and the net effect, of course, which will be just a reduction of temperature by the end of the century by 0.1 degree Fahrenheit. So essentially nothing. And we're simply saying, well, why don't we spend that money much, much better? There's very little overlap. It's perhaps crucial that Carl and I have many times said we agree that we should be investing a lot more in research and development. The problem is we don't. We've actually seen declining levels of investment in research and development, and I would say, since the early 80s. And I would say a large part of that is because we've been focusing so much on cutting carbon emissions in the short term that we've forgotten about the game changer that's really necessary to get everybody on board over the next 20 to 40 years. So fundamentally, there's very little overlap. Remember also we talk about spending about $100 billion a year simply on all the other problems in the world, but that still leaves $150 billion to tackle global warming.
Carl Pope is smiling. Does that mean you had anything? No, okay.
No, I don't need to intercede
on that.
Just
enjoying the conversation.
Just enjoying the conversation.
Thank you. Next question, please.
My name is Jonathan Kevlis. In the interest of full disclosure, I work for the Sierra Club. well done, Carl. I'm confused by Mr. Lomborg's discussion of moving away from installing renewable energy and into R&D, because at least of what I've seen, so much innovation is happening in supply chain improvement and production processes, not initially needed for particularly for photovoltaics, whose prices are really coming down precipitously, like a lot of new technologies in their embryonic stages are now getting so much more cheaper. So I'm curious if you why you don't want us to see more investment, public and private investment, into solar, photovoltaics, and other renewables, when it's that investment itself that creates market innovation, that creates the dropping prices that we're seeing already?
Well, it's a good question. And fundamentally, the point here is to recognize that solar panels are right now, what, say, 10 times as expensive as fossil fuels. If you dramatically increase the spending...
That's a big exaggeration. I'd be happy to show you some more recent numbers from the industry.
Price is coming down rapidly.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, listen, we are not going to have this conversation once they're cheaper than fossil fuels. So the real question here is, do we want to install lots of them when they're still much more expensive? Or do we want to wait? Now, if you say, and let's take for argument's sake, that huge mass production brings it down about a factor of two. So if then we should go when solar panels are twice as expensive in the research stage, and then they will become cheaper than fossil fuels. That's I'm absolutely happy to do that. But do not produce them when they're still hugely inefficient, because then you just end up putting lots and lots of well-meaning solar panels on rooftops. It looks good, it's great for photo ops, but it doesn't actually do anything, or it's an incredibly expensive way to cut carbon emissions. So again, what I'm trying to say is Denmark had a good example, and I point that out in the film as well. We put up lots and lots of incredibly inefficient windmills, and we felt very proud of them. We've cut all of them down. Maybe we shouldn't have put up so many. And, of course, you can have a discussion about should you put up one or do you need to put up 10 or 20 or even 100 to come to the next generation, but you do not need to put up 10,000 is what we did.
Let's try to get one more in if we could.
Hi, I have another question about the $250 billion. what would be the most sensible way of raising that money, and what would, in your opinion, be the most realistic way?
It's the $250 billion question.
We propose to spend $250 billion in the film to tackle all the main problems in the world, including global warming. One obvious way is simply to say, well, the only current legislation on the books on tackling global warming is the EU 2020 policy, and that's going to cost $250 billion. Now, recognizing that I'm not sure EU is going to give up all that money anyway, we might want to think about other ways. And Carl and I would probably agree that if we could, for instance, have a low carbon tax of $7 per ton of CO2, that would actually raise about $250 billion as well. But that's not going to happen either. You know, we certainly know that it's not going to happen in the U.S. It might not happen in China and India. So there's a huge issue of where exactly do you get this sort of money from. The economists would tend to say that these are two very separate problems. How you spend the money well is one problem. That's what I've tried to address. How you raise the money is a very different issue, and that's really much more of one of local policy. So I would encourage us to simply say it's certainly in the doable range. It's certainly much less than what we otherwise talk about we want to spend on climate change. So, you know, let's at least get in that order of magnitude of money up and running from a carbon tax, from cap and trade, from general revenue, or simply from the EU.
I apologize to those who didn't get their questions in. There may be an opportunity afterward, one-on-one. But I've been asked to reserve the last question because it's the newly founded Inforum tradition of 2010 that we're asking all of our speakers the following question. Bjorn, Carl, what is your 60-second idea to change the world? We may need them in 30 seconds at this point.
Well, I pointed out one opportunity where clean energy, low carbon energy is already cheaper than what's screwing up the climate. U.S. coal, I'll now point out another. There are 1.5 billion people in the world who are off the electrical grid. They either use diesel-generated power or most of them use kerosene. Solar electricity in their villages is already 2 to 5 times cheaper than the diesel power and the kerosene they are using. The world, for a sum of money which would build 5 coal-fired power plants, could actually provide the necessary seed capital to provide all 1.5 billion off-grid households on the planet with basic energy services in the form of solar cells and biomass. And I would suggest the world commit itself to that, because in making that deployment, we will know one thing: 1.5 billion people will have light. And we will know another thing: the clean energy sector globally will get much bigger. And I think that could be a game changer.
Bjorn, 1 minute to change the world.
As we try to point out in the film, fundamentally, we are doing very poorly by, for instance, having the EU 2020 policy. let's spend that $250 billion much smarter. Let's spend $100 billion in research and development into green energy. That's about 50 times more than what we spend today. That would be a huge game changer. Let's also invest some money in research and development into geoengineering, because let's face it, there is a risk, and it's the only real way to buy insurance. Then let's also recognize that there are going to be a lot of people hit by global warming, and those people need adaptation. We suggest easy ways that we can make deal with sea level rise, with inland flooding, and with the fact that most people are going to be living in cities, and they're going to be hit doubly hard by increasing heat from global warming and from cities for about $50 billion. That leaves about $100 billion to fix all the other major problems. We could give clean drinking water, sanitation, basic health care, education, and food to everyone on the planet. So do we want to spend $250 billion and do no good 100 years from now, or spend $250 billion, fix global warming, fix the impacts, and also do all the other good things in the world?
And with that, let's all thank Bjorn Lomborg and Carl Pope for sharing their insights with us tonight. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.